Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guests are Kevin Strait and Kinshasa Holman Conwell. They are the co-editors of Afrofuturism, A History of Black Futures. The book is based on the exhibition of the same name at the National Museum for African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. The exhibition immerses visitors in a conversation that reimagines, reinterprets, and reclaims the past and present for a more empowering future for African Americans. And Kevin and Kinshasa, thank you so much for joining Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Well, I have to say, as I was saying before we started recording, that this book has hit such a nostalgic part of me because many of the artists, the musicians, the authors are people I've read, people I've listened to, and it just really touched me. And I will tell you this, the first thing I want listeners to know that this is a beautiful book, aesthetically. It is a beautiful book with incredible pictures. And then it has this intellectual weight tied to beautiful pictures. So that's just real exciting to bring those two together. So I'm gonna start off with you, Kevin, as the museum curator for this particular exhibit at the National Museum. How did this exhibition come together?
That's a good question. I guess I've been thinking about this topic really for quite a while. I think I was exposed to the concepts of Afrofuturism in graduate school. Didn't necessarily focus on it then, but I was always interested in groups like Parliament Funkadelic, and not just thinking about their music, but sort of like the ethos of the band, what the band also presented visually and conceptually through their music. There was always a lot going on, and it was something I think I picked up on as a young musician. And also, well, I guess I mentioned graduate school. I can go back a little bit further. Parliament Funkadelic came to my college to play a blistering three-hour set. And I was exposed to the music before that and kind of really intrigued by that idea of the mothership coming down from, the rafters at the climax of the show. To transport the audiences into this, ethereal realm. But picking up on a lot of that stuff early on, I remember I had an opportunity to speak to George Clinton after that concert. And I asked him pretty bluntly, I was like, so where's the mothership? And you'll forgive me, I don't think I can say this without sort of doing a bad version of his voice. By the way, he's 82 today. So happy birthday to George
Clinton. Happy birthday.
But when I asked him where the mothership was, he said, oh, it's out in space somewhere. It'll be back.
Perfect. So
that always stuck with me. And I remember just, thinking about it then and thinking about it even when I started work at the museum in 2010. We were tasked with building exhibits. I was with the musical Crossroads team. And we were thinking about expressing sort of the gamut of African-American music, but I definitely had an interest in funk and representing, elements of that history. And I got in touch with one of the P-Funk roadies, a guy named Bernie Walden. And he said that, guess what? The mothership still exists, or the version that they were touring in the 90s. The original one had been scrapped for parts long ago. They came up with another vessel, so to speak, for the audiences to really get into and absorb. And
let me jump in here real quick. Because one of the things I want to establish is you saw the mothership. I was in college when the mothership. I was late high school, early college. Mm-hmm. My generation that literally danced to that music when it came out didn't really think of it as Afrofuturism. We right. just thought of it, and this is late 1970s, I guess, that the Tear the Roof Off the Sock and all that came out. So I am interested. I want to get Kinshasa involved in this, because Kinshasa, I want to get you involved because you are the deputy director emerita. You may have to help me with the pronunciation of that. And you helped Kevin to pull this book together. So first, before we talk about you working with Kevin to pull this book together, when you were listening to Parliament and that mothership connection, were you thinking in your mind Afrofuturism, or were you thinking this is great funk?
I was thinking of futurism, Hopeton, but not Afrofuturism. I will reveal to Kevin for the first time that I had a latent interest in things space-like, not Star Trek and Star Wars, but Flash Gordon. And before you think I'm that old, what I liked about Flash Gordon is something that Kevin puts in the exhibition, which is those futuristic costumes. So by the time another generation heard of Lieutenant Uhura, there had been Flash Gordon, you know, in the cheesy, wonderful Buster Crabbe movies, which they showed on television. So I knew there was something futuristic. Now, in terms of Parliament Funkadelic, I love Parliament. I love Funkadelic. I love them together. And I even used some of their lyrics when I would talk. So I was giving a speech about the future of museums, and I said we were standing on the verge of getting it on. And I think a few people got my reference, and others were like, what is she talking about? So I didn't think specifically of Afrofuturism, but I did think of futurism. And so one of the things that we'll talk about more is how brilliant it was of Kevin Strait to figure out, you know, let's capture this as an Afrofuturistic moment and not just a futuristic one.
And if I could just jump in there, Kinshasa, thanks for that. When we were collecting the mothership in 2011, we were contemplating a lot of these things, but mostly just thinking along the lines of what would look amazing in an exhibition. Bringing this iconic stage prop. You can talk about so many different histories. You could talk about the evolution of Black stagecraft in a variety of ways, like from the razor sharp dance moves and sharp suits and that sort of look and feel of Black concerts. To you hit the 70s and you have Gary Scheider wearing a diaper elevated across the audience and the mothership coming down and really just sort of blowing people's minds. But it was that sort of shift shifted in thinking about Black musical production, that really sort of in many ways kind of creates this history. And it's something that we were thinking about as we were devising Musical Crossroads, how to represent an object like this. Do we talk about it purely as an iconic stage prop, or do we talk about its symbolic resonance, why it matters, what drove George Clinton to devise something like this? It's a manifestation of so many things in terms of his interest in popular culture and sci-fi and comic books and things like that, monster movies. But of course, he also wanted to have something that in many ways was falling in similar notions to Sun Ra and Jimi Hendrix in terms of exploring the cosmos in terms of your thinking and having some sort of symbol that would come down and allow the audience to take part in that, to build in a sense that kind of cosmic community.
Can I say something that you've inspired, dear Kevin Strait? You and Hopeton have DC connections. You're a PhD from George Washington, right? Gone originally to WesU, the great Wesleyan University, school of my brother, a school with a great musical heritage, Archie Shepp, et cetera, et cetera. But what I always thought about coming up in New York, in DC as a teenager, is the acceptance by Black people of futuristic things without naming them, right? He was George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic, Mandrill, OCBISA, LaBelle, they were all really popular in DC because Black folks in DC thought, oh yeah, whatever, you know, wear silver suits, come down in a spaceship. It's all in a day's work. And what I think Kevin has done so brilliantly with the show and what our writers have done in the book is break that open and say, okay, folks, while you were dancing to the beat, did you know that there was these connections that go all the way back to Phyllis Wheatley and to W.B. Du Bois and come on through the years and through the writers like Delaney and N.K. Jemisin and Octavia Butler. So even if you never read any of those sci-fi writers, if you didn't know anything about what Dr. Du Bois did, there was this kind of visceral connection. And let me just say this last piece, my friends. When Kevin acquired the mothership, I posted it on Facebook, of course. That was one of my top posts of life. And my friends of all backgrounds, all ages, all races were like, oh my God, Kinshasa. And that you helped validate me. I never told you that, Kevin Strait, but people thought, so by default, I was cool because I knew Kevin and Kevin got the mothership.
Well, let me go ahead and jump to W.E.B. Du Bois because I'm a great admirer of W.E.B. Du Bois. And of course, one of the founders of the NAACP, the Crisis Magazine, the Niagara Movement, the Negroes in Business Report when he was at Atlanta University. I didn't think of W.E.B. Du Bois as a futurist, but I learned what I had forgotten was that he actually was just this savant when it came to writing and experimented with all kinds of narratives. And as the writer of the piece on W.E.B. Du Bois and that's in the book talked about him wanting to explore different narratives and including a short story on science fiction. So Kevin and Kinshasa, talk about that side of W.E.B. Du Bois. We think of him as the NAACP person, but we forget his literary output from the Crisis Magazine to maybe being the first sociologist to all these other things.
Right. Now, I think it was really important for the book and the exhibition to really survey, you know, different forms of Black expression that, you know, pertain to Afrofuturist themes. So taking it outside of just, you know, mid 20th century and into the 21st century kind of perspective, but taking a look back, you know, before the term was created and having these kinds of examples for people to absorb. But in reference to Du Bois and Bill Pretzer, I wrote a wonderful essay in the book, you know, outlining. And
can you say who Bill Pretzer is, Mr. Oh,
William
Dr.
Pretzer
Strait?
Is our senior curator of history at the museum and my supervisor and a wonderful person and a good writer. And he's thought a lot about Du Bois. And I think we challenged him to think about him a little bit differently for this essay, and we were thrilled with it. But you know, and just in that essay and in the exhibition, I think it was about exploring or taking again kind of a deeper dive into Du Bois's notion of the color line being the primary problem of the 20th century for all Americans to deal with, and exploring. How Du Bois, made connections between race, capitalism, and democracy, all in his visual charts. And what I also loved is that he would also portray, accompanying these visual charts that he posted in the World's Fair, 1900, he also portrayed these, lists of Black accomplishments from patents that were made to books that were written, because this was either underrepresented or not represented at all. In most history. So you have Du Bois doing this work in many ways, sort of instilling a notion of Black futures, but also pointing out what's happening in what's happened in the past and what's happened in the present. Right. And also, you know, in terms of him, I guess, evaluating the color line, not only through these visual charts, but as he mentioned, with his literature. I know he wrote The Quest of the Silver Fleece, which was his novel, which addressed some of these themes, but also, of course, The Comet, the short story, which in many ways is a parable about race and where essentially the country is headed if it doesn't address these central problems.
And, you know, what I think that Kevin Strait did in including Du Bois in telling this story is he connected the combination of this great, you know, sociologist and scientist, literary and political figure that straddles the 19th and 20th century, that rightly predicts that, you know, it will be the problem of the color line will be the problem of the 20th century. And what Du Bois did so well is he could code switch between being a Harvard scholar, being Atlanta University, being in my hometown, which when he was first there was, you know, not the cradle of integration, but a viciously segregated town. There's a story of where he passes an establishment and he sees the body parts of a slain Black person. So he's got this great kind of elite education. He's from Great Barrington, Massachusetts, but at the end of the day, he's a Black person. And with the exposition, you know, he's telling the story that Kevin's talking about, but white America and Europe is telling the story of the spectacle of the Black person as something to look at, like look at these people who are somehow these animals really who have been educated. But he flips that and makes that proof of the humanity, the ability of Black people. And then with the writing that Kevin just talked about, he connects us to people like N.K. Jemisin and Delaney and Octavia Butler. And because one of the core things I think that Kevin raises up and the writers raise up is what makes it futuristic is not just the outlandish, to some people's minds, costumes of Donna Hendricks, and I think they're beautiful, of course, but the nerve, right? The audacity of Black people to imagine a future without racism, to imagine a future that is not about white supremacy, but is about Black authenticity and Black agency.
So I want to talk here about switch to the literary side, and specifically in 1998 at MIT, Octavia Butler, who's well-known speculative science fiction writer, who died in 2006, and Samuel Delaney, who fortunately is still alive, were in discussion about science fiction and modern culture. Now, a lot of people have heard about Octavia Butler. There was a series based on her book on Hulu. So she's a fairly well-known figure. The person who is not as well-known is Samuel Delaney. So talk about Butler and Delaney and their importance to Afrofuturism in literature.
Can I talk a little bit about Delaney? Because I have a fun connection to make on that. And I'm going to let Kevin talk about the harder thing, which is Octavia. And I will say, you're a fine man, Hopkin, to think that she is well known. But if you go on the streets of America and ask people who Octavia Butler is, look for faces that are confused.
In my circle. We all know Octavia Butler.
But, well, of course, that's because you're a brilliant and scholarly man. But one more plug for Octavia before I jump to Mr. Delaney. The brilliant Toshi Reagan has just finished, I guess, the tour of Parable of the Sower, which he had in venues around the country based on that work. And by all accounts, it's extraordinary. But one of the interesting things about Delaney, who has a wonderful essay written about him in the New Yorker, published the 15th of this month, more or less, is a man from middle-class Black background. I'm pretty sure I'm right that he's related to the Delaney sisters, who we learned about several years ago as these older Black women about whom a play was written because of their great memories of Black life. He is, people talk about people being openly gay. He is resolutely gay. He is deeply interested in his identity as a gay man. And he also has an interest beyond just gay literature. He kind of goes on the edge of that, but it's all about that extraordinary creative mind. And what I think is interesting about people like Butler and Delaney is that I bet to a great extent, except for you, Hopton, who is a more protean in your knowledge, probably not as many Black people know these writers because in general, speculative fiction is not as at least it's not talked about in the public square by Black people. But what is so interesting is Octavia Butler and Delaney, and of course, N.K. Jemisin, are resolute in having race be a big part of what they talk about, because the very insistence on the future, a future of Black people, where Black people have some say in their lives, and where there's a fantastical notion and a complex notion of Blackness.
In terms of Octavia Butler, you know, it was the section in the exhibit deals with Black sci-fi, and we focus on Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney and Jackie Orms as well. And Jackie Orms, of course, isn't a sci-fi writer. She's a cartoonist. But thinking about the three of them in a specific way in terms of highlighting the importance of their history and their presence in disrupting narratives, really disrupting the field with their very presence. We mentioned Wesleyan before. I'm thinking of my old professor, Anthony Braxton, the musician, and he liked to talk about sort of points of definition and cultural shifts. And I've always thought about Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney sort of landing on the scene and disrupting the norm in terms of not just how speculative fiction is written, but you know, who is producing these stories and what they focused on. And you have speculative fiction that's carving out these, you know, these new spaces. With some of the topics that Kinshasa just mentioned, reference to what Samuel Delaney was writing about, but with Octavia Butler, you know, I was always captivated by the time traveling aspect, but, you know, it was a way for her to, carve out spaces for, to have a discourse about feminism, about Black identity, and about humanity in general. And it's, like I said, that kind of point of definition was imperative for, I think, any discussion of Afrofuturism, where you have to start to point out where, you know, in the 20th century, the new technologies emerge and everything, who's writing about, these themes in their works, and sort of as a starting point with Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney in this new understanding of sci-fi and speculative fiction.
Indeed.
I want to talk a little bit about the film and TV industry. And I won't pivot to the natural pivot, which is usually Black Panther and how it relates to Afrofuturism, but Lovecraft Country, which was I watched that whole series, which was a very interesting take. Talk a little bit about how Lovecraft Country, because they sort of subverted H.P. Lovecraft, who was a racist, yeah, absolute racist, and how he wrote and represented Black people. But talk about Lovecraft Country.
I will now fully admit, Hopin, that was on my queue, and now I don't believe I can find it. I watched the Watchmen series, I was tasked with developing an exhibition, so I didn't get a chance to watch everything that I wanted to watch, including Lovecraft, but I was always struck by the previews and the images, because if anything, it reassured me that this topic is relevant, that it's part of our lexicon, that people are thinking about it, whether or not they're identifying it as Afrofuturism or not. But thinking about Black people and these sort of atypical spaces for heroes, for villains, and just in terms of, settings that you'd find in typical storytelling. I have some examples of the show in the exhibit. I wanted to make sure that, you know, the imagery, which sort of pops off the screen, you have someone in a spaceship at one point, and then they're morphing into Jackie Robinson, and then they're a cosmonaut or something like that. There's a lot going on, but I think, you know, it's representative of that visual style that that's outlandish and futuristic. But, you know, the aesthetic meaning to Afrofuturism is also deeply significant. And I think it's something that people, that's really the first thing that they kind of maybe notice too, about Afrofuturism as a concept, as an aesthetic, as a cultural movement. It's the look and feel, and you know, when visualizing Afrofuturism that you can kind of sense in these examples. It was amazing to sort of see it work into fruition.
Can I just say a little something? I as like Hopeton, I watch every single solitary episode, and I was dismayed that it was not renewed. Not surprised, but dismayed, because even though some extraordinary other things have been on, it probably took more risks than most things about Black people that I've seen on television. And what connected to a lot of what you're doing, Kevin, in the show and the book, is that it situates its characters in the past, the present, and the future. And they time jump, they code switch, they do everything. And there are these layers and layers. And what I love, again, is generation of conversation is what I think is really powerful in Black culture. And you know, Black people, we call all kinds of stars by their first names. You know, so Jimi Hendrix is Jimmy, right? And Michael Jackson is Michael. I call James Brown Mr. Brown out of deference to his excellence. But so the next day after Lovecraft, which went across the spectrum of my Black friends. I mean, my friends who think, you know, Star Trek was corny, or who wouldn't touch Star Wars, haven't looked at a comic book in life, to my aficionados who love comic books and love speculative fiction. They love Lovecraft, and part of it was because of that, you know, they introduced the Tulsa riots in the story. I'm sorry, Chad Williams.
That was Watchmen.
Watchmen.
No. Tulsa.
Oh, in both.
Oh, go, absolutely. Tulsa is deep in Lovecraft, but I'm sorry, the Tulsa race massacre. Please forgive my language. It's brilliant, and it's frightening, and it's powerful. And I think in some ways, it stepped over a line of what popular television, even HBO, which prides itself on breaking the codes and all that. And it was extraordinary. So the day after every episode, my friends were saying, did you see this? And there was signifying all over. There might be a sign. There was the name of a cafe. I don't know, Hopeton, if you remember it, but it's in the background in a scene, and it's just there. And if you see it, so the next day everybody was pointing out the, remember, in the background there's a scene, and remember that reference is to this. So anyway, I think there will be many PhD theses written about that series, because it is rich with imagery and it is deeply Afrofuturistic. So your instinct was absolutely right, Kevin. You just knew that was the bomb.
So well, tell I, me, Go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to say, you know, along with that show and so many others, I was thinking of Southside, which was also on HBO for a while. Just an explosion of, you know, television dealing with, you know, Black actors, Black producers, Black themes, Black settings. And it's wonderful to see. Not all those shows exist anymore, but it seems like more and more have been coming out recently.
That's right.
So talk about how you collaborated in pulling this book together. Give us a snapshot of what that was like. What was a typical day in collaboration?
Can I say that it's very important to note for the record that it began in the mind of Kevin Strait, and it continued in a parallel world with the encouragement of our founding director, Lonnie Bunch and Bill Pretzer, who was mentioned earlier, and then the stalking of poor, innocent Kevin Strait by Kinshasa. Every few months I'd say, yo, Kevin, what's up, bro? How you doing? What's happening with that Afrofuturism? And don't you want to do a book? And every time I saw that someone was doing an Afrofuturism program, dear Greg Tate, to whom we dedicate this book, was alive then. I'm saying, Greg Tate just did a so-and-so, so-and-so did a so-and-so. I just saw something about, whomever, Nona Hendricks, or it'd be really great if N.K. Jemisin could be involved. And so I wanted to make it clear to Kevin that I was supporting this. And the other thing is, as someone who brag, is this a humble brag or just a plain old brag? I published, edited and co-edited a lot of the books at the museum. So I figured I had a little juice. So I harassed everyone from Lonnie Bunch to his temporary successor, Dr. Spencer Crew, to the current director, Kevin Young. I said, we really ought to do this, Kevin. And I also remember I'm embarrassed, Kevin. We've talked about the process, Kevin Strait. He was asked to do a presentation. It was not a meeting with visuals, but he was just explicating the thesis to the senior leadership of the museum. And after he finished talking, Hopeton, there was this pause because everybody was mesmerized and no one could see me, but I was just going, yes. I was like, we've got these people. And then our collaboration, I must say, with Carolyn Gleason, the head of Smithsonian Books, was superb. She and her team, Julie Huggins and Matt Litz, and toward the end, Jamie, was extraordinary. And you, last little plug, you talked about the design. I was really, not that anyone resisted it, but I was really promoting, I think we should have a Black designer, and I think we should have somebody at the top of their game. So my friend Benny Johnson, a brilliant designer, marketeer, and everything else, said, then you need to consider Pentagram, and you need to consider Eddie O'Power. And Eddie O'Power and his colleague, Mr. June Jung, were the designers, and they knocked it out of ballpark. But remember, stalking is maybe illegal, Hopeton, but there's nothing wrong with it in the advancement of ideas. And Kevin had all the original ideas. Then I just jumped on and claimed, no, I didn't. But we went over the list of potential authors and went back and forth. And I was doing the workmanlike stuff of tracking down. I stalked them too. So I stalked N.K. Jemisin to the end of the earth. He knows Alondra Nelson. I didn't know her, but that didn't stop me. A good friend of mine, Pat Cruz, knows Nona Hendricks. He said, what do you mean you can't get Nona? Da 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 da. And then a number of the other people, like John Jennings, will just do anything Kevin says. So they were in, great.
I just to add to that, and thanks so much for the heck of a chat. I will say, among all those things that I remember after giving that mothership talk in 2011, you and I chatted about this. This is a topic that was, you and I had been talking about really for years.
Yes.
And I had just finished up work on the Afrofuturism Symposium that we were doing, an online virtual symposium. You have to remember this is
brilliant.
2021 into 2022. Yes. So we're still dealing with the pandemic. And I remember getting an email from Kinshasa saying, we're going to think about the book again. And so that's when I just started really developing the outline, but also knowing that there's no way to complete a book without Kinshasa. Kinshasa will help organize virtually every element of thought that goes into it. And help it sort of make sense. And knowing Kinshasa's background, not only in terms of helping us produce books, but just in terms of having such a deep understanding of African American art, just having you on board was crucial to us finishing developing a book that I think we're proud of. So it was a process where we definitely. Made that a priority as I was finishing up the exhibition. We were also working, several days a week in terms of getting the ideas together for the book and also discussing which authors to include, how to go about doing that, getting the images together. It all materialized in the span of about 10 months. So we were working pretty hard. Yeah.
So let me ask you this, because I gave this book to my 17-year-old daughter, who is also at one point was studying art in school, and she just absolutely fell in love with it. I look at this book, which is an incredible book, as a great teaching aid
for
young people.
That's right. It is being added to the curriculum in certain schools. So not that I'm interested in book sales at all, but it's going to boost the wonderful book sales. I don't know when this podcast will play, so I can't tell you about the imminent release of the paperback. I can't mention that because I don't know. So pretend I didn't say anything, but soon and very soon we'll hear about that. But this book, I predict, will go into multiple printings as a paperback also comes out. But Kevin has deeper connections to academe, and there are people who want this. Libraries want this because it is such a versatile tome, just as the exhibition is, Hopeton. I mean, I could take my 3-year-old and 8-year-old great grand nieces and nephews into the exhibition, and they were like Wakanda crazy, right? So they're doing the pose in front of the Black Panther, but they're also looking at the interactives about every aspect, and they're looking at those big screens where you see Itasha Womack or John Jennings speaking. And so you can be an 8-year-old kid and not know who the heck Reinaldo Anderson is, but you know that you're surrounded by this. And let me say, I think in my racial pride, the Blackness of it really translates. And it translates to everyone. I mean, I went through the exhibition and I'm seeing a young white father with his child is kind of pointing to things and trying to, you say, come over here, look at this. Because in the exhibition and in the book, there's an entry into Black culture from whatever age and whatever background. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so powerful.
Well, I really think people need to go to this exhibition.
Yes.
Washington, D.C. It ends March 24th. You have to go to
2024.
2024.
That's correct.
And I'm pointing my finger at all the people who aren't watching this because this is audio, but you have to go to visit this exhibition because I think this exhibit is so important in terms of cultural pride, understanding the connection between the past, the present, and the future, and the importance of Black culture to moving the Black community ahead.
Yes, absolutely. It is powerful. There are moments in it. So there's a beautifully poignant space where there's something about Trayvon Martin, which is one of the most tragic stories of Black life, this sweet young child who was murdered. But then underpinning all of that, there is the hopefulness. And even if you ever meet his beautiful parents, they're not only about mourning their son's death, but they're also about celebrating his life and his dreams and, you know, his involvement in the NASA program. And you know, there's just so many stories. I mean, the great story that is told in the book about the great actress who played Lieutenant
Michelle Nichols,
right? And Dr. King, what did Dr. King say to her?
He urged her to stay with the show when she was thinking about leaving after 1 year. They had a chance meeting, and he urged her to stay because of her positive influence.
Wow. Well, look, I'm going to have to wrap it up here, but Kevin, I'm going to give you the last word. I want you to a 30-second overview of why everybody listening to this needs to come to the National Museum for African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., and visit this exhibition, Afrofuturism, A History of Black Futures. 30 seconds, Kevin.
Well, I think that it's a good way to unpack the term and to see the multiple ways in which it's been expressed over time through literature, through film, through activism, through music and more. The hope is to uncover its long history and its long engagement with popular culture and to see how in many ways, even though this term was developed in the 1990s by scholars, to see how this has been a driver of Black culture really across time and space and throughout the Black diaspora. So that's the hope that we, the audience will come to the exhibit and we'll get a better sense of what Afrofuturism is and how it connects to our larger culture.
Kevin M. Strait and Kinshasa Holman-Conwell, co-editors of Afrofuturism, A History of Black Futures, thank you so much for being guests on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thanks you, so much, Hopin.
Thank you.